Pablo, thanks for joining me. This is a follow-on to the fascinating presentation that you gave at MIX about Astoria. Here I want to focus on the main themes of the talk and of the project, starting with why, in the first place, to take this RESTful HTTP-oriented approach to generic patterns of data access.
One of the key reasons is just simplicity. I mean, one of the sort of beautiful things about the whole HTTP pattern, and as all of the folks that came up with the initial assessment about REST and whatever REST means, as a way of building applications without trying to pick on the details of what it actually means. These folks realized very early that simplicity in this aspect is what keeps the internet working. And if it works for the internet, it has to be sort of, it's already proven that it's not going to get in your way for scalability. You're not going to be sort of limited in the applications you can build and so on. So, data access, particularly when you look at it from the perspective of the technologies that are out there in the middle tier for enterprise development or stuff like that, it does tend to get complicated. So this was sort of a comeback to the only principles of what exactly do you need and provide services that address the bare needs of what an application needs. And in this particular case, in the context of web applications.
Yeah.
So the whole web is driven off of resources. And it's sort of a natural thing, although typically we don't think of this as this way, but it's just a natural thing to say all data, including data in databases or other sources, is just a resource, and we're trying to sort of shape it like that and present it like that over a very, very simple HTTP interface.
It will be immediately obvious to anyone who watches the demo what the idea here is, which is that every view of the data has an associated URI, and those things are related to one another in a discoverable and navigable way. But what's not immediately obvious up front, and maybe that's actually a good place to start here, is how was the entity model constructed, and what kind of a service is running on the back end such that it's possible to interact with the data in this RESTful way?
The entity data model that the Astoria layer builds on top of, so the actual instance that you are using to project, you know, whatever data source you want to project.
Yeah.
I mean, the ADM is a schema sort of definition. It's a data model, and it comes with a schema definition mechanism, which is just a bunch of files you put somewhere. The typical way where you start doing this is in Visual Studio. There is a wizard, if you're using Visual Studio Orcas, that you can point to a database, and we will take a look at the database schema, and we produce a sort of a one-to-one mapping to EDM for you. So if you want to just not know about EDM, or you just want to expose your database, you don't need to think too much about this. You just point to a database, and we produce a reasonable mapping that is already functional. So now you can point Astoria to it.
These generated .NET classes that you are using for this purpose, that's the same stuff that is being generated for example, the kinds of link demos that Anders has been showing recently. That's the same thing?
Yeah, it's similar. I mean, it's the same pattern. So the details, like the attributes, are different.
Because
the sort of the EVM runtime is not the same as the link to SQL runtime.
Ah, okay. Didn't know that.
But the entity framework, which is the sort of the concrete implementation of the EVM that we are shipping next, a little bit after Orcas, it's fully link-enabled. So you can use, I mean, the patterns are the same. You can use link, and for link, you need to use these types. So structurally, they're very similar. You can certainly use them on the server side, like we emit the types, and if maybe half of your application is a server-side application, or maybe you render some ASP.NET pages on the server or something, you can use those types as a way of formulating link queries and also as a way of representing the results. But the nice thing is that these are since both the types and the sort of the Astoria resource space that is presented against a given EDM model are driven by the same model. The nice thing is that both your object interface in the middle tier and the HTTP interface that is web-facing are based on the same model, so they are identical.
Yes.
So they share the same nouns and so on.
Yes.
And if you, like, let's say if you customize the mapping so you no longer have the mapping that the wizard produced, maybe you rename some tables or some columns or rearrange the structure of the data somehow.
Okay.
So you get a different EDM view that is not the same as the database. It's somehow mapped differently. And that different view applies both to your middle tier objects and to the HTTP interface. So it's also very nice. It's a very nice way of, you can reshape the level of or you can reshape the view of the database from your particular application. And that view of the database applies to both the code you write on the server side of your application and the code you write on the client side consuming, you know, the HTTP entry points.
And the process for doing that reshaping is what?
Let's say you start with an existing database. It's typical, you know, steps is you create your database or you have one. You point to the database, we generate a default mapping.
Yes.
And the mapping is one XML file that we produce and is part of your project. And the process of adjusting the sort of the mapping is you go to the mapping file, change the mapping, and you go to the EVM schema and change the schema any way you want.
Mm-hmm.
If you do it today, like say with the Entity Framework bits and the Orca and the Astoria bits that are out there for download.
Yeah.
This is not a fun process because you have to do it editing the XML files.
Yes.
Which is, you know, maybe it's an interesting thought or exercise or something, but it's no, you know, you don't want to spend your time there.
And you certainly can't round trip your way through those exercises.
Well, you could, but it just takes more time.
Okay.
You have to snapshot the versions.
Okay.
So now we're actively working on tools, and by the way, we are. By the time we ship the Entity Framework, which we're targeting, you know, Q2 next year, we will also have proper tools so that you can visually adjust your mappings and stuff like that. So at that point, it just becomes a design surface in Visual Studio where you can tweak what is the view of the data for your particular app.
Okay.
So then coming back to sort of the process of what's running underneath. So once you define your model, regardless of you know, maybe it was a default model before, maybe you customized the model or you know, whatever. In any case, what you have or what's going on the server side is that the Astoria runtime is a relatively small runtime. That what you do is you point to one of these model definitions, and the runtime itself is a Windows Communication Foundation extension.
Right.
And it's a user extension, meaning this is something that's done externally. It's not like we modified WCF itself or anything.
Right.
I mean, we know them and they help us find the right hooks. But other than that, it's just an regular extension.
Right.
And what we do is simply we sort of intercept WCF a lot, so that the WCF services that are exposed, that are Astoria services, they know the data they are being backed by, and they know because we redirect to our code for that. And so when you're interacting with the system, what you are doing basically is typically you're going through HTTP, so IIS is somewhere in the middle, the, mm-hmm. Like Internet Information Server. And then from there, we typically run in the ASP.NET environment, and WCF is handling sort of the interactions and all of the communication stuff. And very quickly, Astoria picks that up. And what Astoria does is simply sits in between the data source and the HTTP layer, in this case, the WCF HTTP binding.
Yeah. So I guess there's a couple levels of interception here. There's the one that produces the HTTP interface. Mm-hmm. And then there's another level, as you pointed out, where it's possible to intercept and transform and filter
yes.
the data. And that gets to be really important because... You know, we've had in various ways over the years, we've had these kind of raw interfaces to databases on the web, you know, where you would just get these massive dumps of XML coming out in response to queries. And, you know, it was always on the one hand quite interesting, but on the other hand, very uncontrolled.
Yep.
And so you spent a fair amount of time in the demo showing how to apply the kinds of controls that you would want without, however, compromising the utility of the model, right?
Mm-hmm.
The ability to continue to use the full range of expression
yep.
that you have in these patterns, right? So talk a little bit about that. I think one very good example in the demo is the Encarta one, where, you know, if somebody were to simply do, you know, a high-level HTTP request, you know, for all of the article bodies, it would be insane.
Yeah. I guess the observation that motivated introducing these features was that usually there is a trade-off there, and the trade-off is just too hard, right? Because on one end of the spectrum, as you say, you can have an interface that allows sort of free query, and
yeah.
you can query for anything and you can return anything, and that's easy to do, and it's very practical for whoever is consuming the entry point. But it's almost impossible to guarantee that the server will survive that because you can ask for anything in any
yes.
shape, any amount of data, and so
yes.
on. The other end of the spectrum where you control everything is the traditional RPC model,
mm-hmm.
where you have So even if you use a URL, in the end, the thing looks like a function call. You
yeah.
put some function name, pass some parameters, and you have a fixed output.
Yes.
The problem with that is now you sacrificed all of your flexibility. Like, you cannot express any queries. You cannot express sort of sorting or paging constructs or things like that.
Right.
The mechanism in Astoria that allows to go somewhere in the middle of these two things is we need to find a shorter name. So far, we've been calling them data-aware service operations, borrowing the WCF service operation term.
Mm-hmm.
And these are functions that you can define on the server side, and that you can run any code inside the function. If you bind it to the get method, it's nice that you don't cause side effects. We don't prevent it, but you know it's sort of bad form to cause side effects on get, and it's a security problem.
Yep.
What happens is, so when somebody in the URL sort of resource space points to your function and passes arguments, we call your function. The trick is, inside the function, you run any code you want, but on the output, you do not return the results to the system. I mean, it is sort of the Astoria runtime that is calling you. You don't return the results. Instead, what you return is a query formulation.
Mm-hmm.
So in Entity Framework, and in Link in general, there is a clear definition of what a query is, right? It's some instance of something implementing a queryable. So
you're talking about a Link query expression
yes.
in its internal form.
Yeah, well, you don't need to know that. I mean, it is internally, but from the user perspective, it just returns a query object.
Yeah,
and you can write a query in Link. In the CTP of Astoria that is out there, because of various glitches, you cannot use the Link syntax. You have to use builder methods with strings.
Yeah,
but that's just a glitch. It's not sort of the plan. The idea is that you just write a Link query and you return the query object without enumerating over it first.
So would you say that Astoria would not be possible without Link, or only would be much more difficult?
Link buys us two things that are key. I think so. I guess the answer is it would be possible, but it would not be as nice.
Yeah.
The two things you get from Link is, one is you get to plug in anything that implements a queryable,
mm-hmm.
and the Entity Framework itself is already has a provider model. So if you want to plug in a database, the Entity Framework is the way to go, because you get the full expressiveness of the framework and you get all those services.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to plug in something like, you know, Link to Flickr, or you know, some random implementation of something that is not quite a database, but it has an iQueryable interface,
mm-hmm.
right? We can still do something for you, and without requiring you to make everything look like a database. So that's one aspect.
Okay.
And the other aspect is, in cases like this where you want to return a query object, not the results of a query. If you didn't have Link, you will have to return maybe a query in quotes or something
right.
like that. So it wouldn't be as nice.
Right.
You can do it, but you know the way it works now is very very elegant. Like,
so
basically, you formulate a query and you literally return the query you just wrote.
Yeah.
And the system can pick up that query and further compose that query and say, well, take this query and then maybe sort it with this different sort of criteria, or maybe sort of do paging and pick up the third page of the results or things like that, independently of which query you actually returned.
Okay, so can you talk through, in the case of the Encarta example, which I think is a very nice one,
uh-huh.
can you talk through how what you just described plays out in that situation?
Yeah, so the Encarta one it has one key characteristic, which is we wanted to return one article at a time, not
right.
even a set.
Right.
So we only wanted to say, you can browse the article headings where you have the title and the, you know, a brief description and so on. But once you want to retrieve a particular article, like it takes a fair amount of CPU to encode the article and ship it to the client. So we didn't want to, as you said, we didn't want to enable a sequential scan over them.
Right.
So what you do there is you get the short list, the list of titles, and you get the key of one of the articles. And what we have is we have a function that takes an article key or an article identifier. And the function simply does a quick query that says select article body from articles where the key equals the argument.
Right.
Right. It doesn't say it in this syntax, but that's the idea. So we retrieve the article, and what we do is we return a one-row result set from the function. So effectively, and the other half of this trick is that we disable access to the articles table or the articles entity set,
mm-hmm.
so that you cannot say slash. Like in the URL, you cannot say slash article bodies. You don't see that. It's like that doesn't exist, although there is a table with that name.
Uh-huh.
By policy, you can turn that off, So but now nobody can access them,
right,
which was the goal initially.
Right.
And now by having this function that takes an article key and returns one article row, you have access to individual articles without having to enable full scan of all of the articles. You could have imagined something like, for example, if you had very granular categories where a category has only a few articles related to that category, you could imagine also having a function that says, give me all of the article bodies for this category.
Mm-hmm.
And then you will formulate a query. You know, you will imagine the query is like select the article where from articles where the category ID equals blah. The nice thing about that is you still return same as before. You just return the article body as bodies in this case as a few rows, but the client can still sort them or page over them and so on. And you have a very controlled way of interacting with the article base at that point. You know, for example, that maybe you can impose it in your query itself. You know that you will never return more than 10.
So what would you say to someone who, from a DBA perspective, says, I like the sound of this, but I worry that there are so many possible permutations,
mm-hmm,
and I can't think of them all ahead of time. So
yeah.
I'm concerned that this is a relatively procedural way of applying these controls, mm-hmm, and I wish it were more declarative and policy-driven.
Yeah. So this is a great question. So we have a few policies, but certainly the by the most part the customization mechanisms are, as you say, procedural. So there are a number of things DBAs can do or can sort of contribute to this overall scheme. One is because of the way Astoria is designed is if you want to use the URL interface, that effectively fills and is dynamic SQL. So
mm-hmm,
maybe there is a subset of your database where you're comfortable with people doing dynamic SQL over it,
mm-hmm,
and you can just enable it by just letting people go straight to the tables through the URL form.
Mm-hmm.
Now, typically, there is a part of your database, sometimes it's small, sometimes it's all of it, that you want more control, either because of security reasons or because of predictability reasons in the query plans or so on.
Yeah.
So for that, you can do two things. One is you can put stored procedures in the database, and then on the client, or not the client, on the Astoria middle tier, what you can do is you can, in these functions we were talking about before, you can just bind to the stored procedure from that function.
Oh.
Of course, once you bind to a stored procedure, there is no query composition on top of them.
Okay.
So you cannot
okay.
do sorting, for example,
okay.
like further sorting.
Okay.
But, I mean, that's fine. Typically, stored procedures constitute the public interface to a database, and sometimes there are really good reasons for that.
Yeah.
So you actually don't want people to sort by an arbitrary column because maybe there is no index there and the
yeah.
table is very big or
yeah.
you know there are reasons for that.
Yeah.
So effectively you can fix the interface at the Astoria level just like you can fix the interface at the database level.
Yeah.
And because we typically layer on top of the entity framework has a mechanism to say that in addition to using stored procedures for data retrieval, you can replace the automatic sort of DML generation for updates. You can replace that with custom store procedures.
Right.
So you can actually shield your whole database with the store procedures, and we'll use them both for data retrieval and for update. So when you say HTTP put to put a resource, we'll understand that we have to take that, turn it into store proc call, and call the store procedure.
Hmm. Yeah,
so
yeah.
You get a very rich interface there. You can also, and then there are more sophisticated options. You can even do table-valued functions if your database does them. And then you get somewhere in between. Like with table value functions, you can have a function encapsulated in the database, but also we support query composition on top of that, so that you get sorting and filtering and
stuff
like that.
We'll come back to the HTTP put thing,
mm-hmm,
but I wanted to circle back. So at the beginning, you said, well, nobody really agrees on what REST is or means,
mm-hmm,
and that's true. But there's a book that's out, which I like quite a bit by Leonard Richardson and Sam Ruby that just came out. It's called RESTful Web Services.
Yeah.
And I like it a lot because it takes things many steps beyond the Fielding dissertation and into the territory of, really, what are the kinds of characteristics that we're looking for here as best practices? And one of them is this notion of dense interconnectivity and just things being rich with links. And that's clearly happening in the case of Astoria, right? So when in the demo, you do the sort of top level query, it tells you, well, the URI for this customer view is and the URI is in fact encoded within the results, which is actually really important. And then as well, the, you know, the relative, I think you call it, you use href attributes, you know, for the, so the orders off of this customer and so on, are, you know, that the URIs are all there in a way that invites exploration.
Yes.
And which is, you know, I think just a critically important aspect to this whole deal. But, you know, the flip of that is back to that DBA paranoia, right? It's, you know, well, you've invited people to, you know, effectively spider this whole data set, and so now you need to, you know, you need to understand on the other end of the deal what the
how you're going to control that access.
But you know, I mean, I think it's you know, that you've absolutely internalized, you know, one of those, what to me are key principles, right? Which is that, you know, in this, you know, it's like, well, what is REST? Well, it's partly about just that, you know, the same way that the web is a web of linked things, you know, these collections of data that we've been working with, they are the same, or they can be the same, and it's extremely useful to model them that way.
I completely agree. By the way, I also agree with the book. I read it and I love it. It's mandatory reading for the Astoria team members because I actually think they did a great job characterizing in a very realistic and very pragmatic way how to build these things. I loved that they didn't get too hung up on just the principles. I mean, they go and it's a very principled approach, which is always good. But then on top of that, they add a lot of practical notes on saying, look, the real world not always is that nice, and here's how you work around this reality or something.
Yes.
So I think the book is great. So coming back to hyperlinking, yes, absolutely. I mean, they discussed that in the book. It was great because I read it after sort of building the initial prototype of Astoria. And I was happy to read that there is at least a few folks that we're all thinking the same way, and that's great to hear. I agree. Hyperlinking is super important. It does create some concerns, but, you know, the whole web survived this, right? And it works pretty well this way. And in the end, I mean, where the data are records, your data are records, or your data are something else. Like, you know, here in Microsoft, if I want to check out, you know, things like my pay stub or my HR, you know, my human resources records, or all of this information, it's all links, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they are protected, and this system survives, and nobody else other than me, or I don't know, I guess my manager perhaps, can see them. Mm-hmm. And they are just links, right? And whether or not there are records in some database after that, it's not important at this point.
Mm-hmm.
The database itself is protected. You know, people have survived this before, I think. You have to be careful about these things. Like, you know, hyperlinking does help you get to more data than you would get otherwise. But this only means that you have to have solid and simple, so people can understand, security policies that you can set up on these things to say how far a given user can go in the sort of in the hyperlinked graph.
Yeah, yeah.
And the, you know, the May CTP of Astoria didn't have a real security model. We put in something just to, you know, not be totally lame about it, but we are working hard at designing a reasonable and flexible security policy mechanism that is still simple enough that people, you know, it doesn't have to be rocket science to understand it.
So then come back to the HTTP put, the idea that this isn't only a read interface, it's a read-write interface, and data can flow back in the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
And talk a little bit about the strategy there for exposing write operations.
The initial principle is we wanted this thing to be usable to write real applications, right? And yeah, you know, just putting an XML face to a database and putting that on a web-facing mechanism is not going to cut it. We needed a full read-write mechanism, and we wanted to follow, you know, the same HTTP infrastructure that was already there. We didn't want to invent anything. So the interface is actually very simple. What we do is we map HTTP post to insert, meaning you post to the container, not to a particular thing, and we model that as an insert, and we return you whatever we inserted, including if we produce keys, we give you the keys that we produced in case there are automatically generated keys, so you can find what you created. Then for put, and there is some debate about this even in the web these days, and I've been sort of not very engaged in the sort of blog space lately, but eventually, I need to get into that discussion. So there is some discussion these days around put meaning replace versus patch, which will be a sort of an HTTP verb that sort of models a merge update semantics. Right.
Versus update, which was just introduced by our colleagues in Live Contacts.
Yes, versus update, which So I know Yaron, and like we work very close together.
Yeah.
And we're, you know, we're engaged in trying to make sense out of all this and be as similar as possible.
Yeah.
So yeah, there is update and there is patch, and so there's this whole discussion. Honestly, like I don't wanna be arbitrarily different. So we're watching this discussion, and we have our own thoughts, which eventually we'll share. My take on this is, like, I don't want to get too deep and too philosophical about this.
Yep.
The reality is that the original semantics for put is that you will replace a file with another.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, put should be a full replace. That has some practical implications that really get in the way. And patch is a verb that, as much as it is nice because semantics are clear, it's not there. Gateway, like proxies, will not like it. You know,
exactly.
Firewalls would not like it.
Exactly.
So too many things will happen. And the reality is, when you're writing an application, typically you don't replace the whole record when you're making a change. You change the name of your contact, or you change the date of some other record or whatever. So right now, you know, we put in Astoria right now means merge, so means patch.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see if people can live with that or not.
Did you have an opinion on the speculative example in the book about modeling transactions using a RESTful put approach?
I think that was probably the one thing I didn't react positively to.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, around the example, they had comments, and the comments that they had sort of addressed a lot of the issues. But so basically, their pattern was to say, look, just initiate the transaction, we'll give you a cookie,
mm-hmm.
and then give us that cookie through all of the operations you want in that transaction, and then you will say commit.
Mm-hmm.
And when you say commit, we'll go execute all together.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes assumptions like, for example, the transformation set is bounded, which may or may not be true in practice. Like in the example of you're transferring from, you know, the canonical example where you say I'm transferring money from one account to the other, the process is bounded in the sense that you know there are two changes.
Yeah.
So that you can buffer. But for for large number of changes, buffering the changes may be a challenge.
Yeah.
And then there is just a plain aspect of, you know, it can be tricky to represent that as a real transaction. What do you do? What is the abort mode? You know, I think there is a class of scenarios where that works well, and I think it's something like the example they had where you have, you know, a fixed number of operations that you want to do together.
Mm-hmm.
I think that for more complicated things like that, in the end, what that means typically is that you are modeling an operation rather than a resource transformation. And I know this sort of deviates from the resource-centric world, but I think that there is a point where maybe this is an entry point to the system that feels more like an action semantic rather than a resource transform.
Hmm.
And maybe at that point you have an slash do something. My favorite example is, if you're building I happen to have built CRM systems in the past. If you're building a CRM system, one of the modules of those things are marketing campaigns. And those things, when you kick off a marketing campaign, you do a bunch of stuff. Because
mm-hmm.
you create follow-up records for all of the customers in the category you want to apply the marketing campaign to. You set up the state of the customers. You create bindings with salespeople that have to follow up on particular guys. So there is a whole transform of the database that you perform.
Mm-hmm.
Those may be more than creating a marketing campaign record. So for those, maybe you have a slash create marketing campaign, and it looks like a function call, and
mm-hmm.
you know, it's slightly deviated from the REST interface, but at least the semantics or the intent of the entry point is very clear in the when the developer sees it and tries to use it.
So that would be the general answer then in terms of how you think about something transactional from the Astoria perspective. At least that's how you're thinking about it now.
That's how we're thinking about that now. Honestly, I haven't thought about the style that they documented in the book until I read the book, which was after I shipped the first version of Astoria, ETP. I think the approach is interesting. I don't see ourselves doing it.
Yeah.
But that's just because so far we haven't run into the scenario. I mean, we're trying to be careful about just doing things when we run into application scenarios for them.
Yeah.
If we find that people are needing it to build their things, you know, we'll consider it again.
Yeah. So talk a little bit more about what kinds of application scenarios you do see. I mean, we know they're going to be mostly read and some write. What's the sort of scope of possibility here? Is it, do you see, do you see it being just completely open-ended, or do you see that there's really a class of things that will best fit?
So I think it's fairly open-ended. I see that there are a couple of architectures, or I hear the word architectures.
Yeah.
There are a couple of sort of style of applications that will work more naturally, but it's more of more in the sense of class of applications more than a particular application. Like I imagine, so Ajax applications in general are I think are going to benefit from this, just because this means you don't have to roll your own. So I think it's just it's a time saver, and also I'm hoping that and this is slowly happening at least internally. I'm hoping that there will be a small ecosystem of JavaScript libraries and JavaScript controls or widgets that just natively understand the URL format, so that when you're building an app, not only you don't have to or you don't need to roll your own service side that hits the database, but also you don't need to roll the individual components on the client that know how to deal with it. You just sort of stitch together the page by putting widgets and libraries that are already there.
You showed a great example of that in the demo. So I guess this was an ASP.NET control that was kind of cooked up for you for this purpose. It comprehends these patterns for multiple styles of query and display and sorting and paging.
Exactly.
And then, as you showed, right, the value here is that those patterns are reusable across very different data sets. And so your one key example was, Northwind, but then switching to Encarta, right, the same control makes a whole lot of sense and can do a whole lot of things with those two very different databases.
Yeah, exactly. I'm hoping that this will keep happening, right? And both folks inside Microsoft and outside of Microsoft can build infrastructure that understand these URLs natively. Then building this class of applications becomes critically simpler, right? Because you get to focus on what you're trying to build rather than all of this infrastructure. And this is particularly important in the sort of in the Ajax world because I mean the technology is just too new and there is not a lot of infrastructure out there. Even the development environments are not great for this. So the less time you have to write to spend writing infrastructure code, the sooner you get your application done. So I think that's one of the key sort of beneficiaries of this thing. Serverlight applications are certainly going to sort of use this. This is same problem space, right? You ship the data, you ship the code, but where is the data? And we are building in the CTP that we shipped. We have a .NET client library to make it easier to talk to the C to Astoria services, but that client doesn't run in Silverlight. So very soon, like any day now, we will actually make a small download available that you can. That you can get and you can use to run data access code like Astoria data access code right from inside your Silverlight application.
Do you think that it has possibilities on the desktop?
You mean using sort of the library to access the Astoria system?
Using Astoria to provide these kinds of views of a variety of data sources that are local on the
Yeah,
desktop.
I think so. I think there are a lot of applications out there that sometimes we don't see as such, but they are web applications. It's just that they chose not to use the browser. I mean, if you like, without going too far, like any of the sort of the media players, clients from any brand, I mean, they are very, very dependent on the web for. I mean, sure, they play songs locally, but all of the sort of buying songs, browsing song catalogs, and so on, those are online exercises, right? So they are just a different front end to a music site. If you go from there to all the way to, Media Center, when you browse your channel guide, that's coming from the web. I mean, sure, that's cached locally, but that information is coming from the web, and you can see a lot of examples. So yeah, I actually think there is an interesting opportunity there for. So the full desktop applications that are still internet-enabled, and this gives you a way of building these internet-enabled stories without having to roll a website or anything. Basically, the only thing you have in your web server side is just your
Your
sort of
data
data
service.
entry point.
Yeah,
Yeah,
agreed,
yeah,
agreed.
yeah, yeah. And the other class that of apps that may pick it up, but we'll see what happens. Is have you seen Popfly?
Sure.
Or Yahoo Pipes,
Sure.
all of these.
Oh, yeah.
So these are different forms. They are fairly different, these two, but these are different forms of things you can basically, they enable you to build whole small apps online. They never touch your disk, right? And so the sort of immediate question that I have there, just because I'm a database nerd, is, well, what is your data? right? I mean, sure, you can pick up RSS feeds, but those are read-only, and also those you don't produce them.
Yep.
So I think in those spaces, it is interesting to see how Astoria can contribute by having a data source that first, you get to define, you know, what data is there, what shape it has, and so mm-hmm. on. And second, is read-write. Mm-hmm. So now whatever you build there can have a state of its own.
Mm-hmm.
We've been toying with that. We have a few demos of PopFly going, and where we just, like, we didn't touch PopFly. We just used PopFly and built small mashups on top that take data from the, you know, we have this online service of Astoria.
Yeah, so you provided a PopFly block that can talk to Astoria?
Yeah. Right now, it's like all we did is we provided sort of database-specific blocks. So we have a Northwind block.
Yep.
We are thinking to see if it is possible to do a genetic sort of Astoria block or something. I don't know if we'll do something. But I think sort of the high-order bit there is there are all of these sort of environments out there that let you build applications entirely online where you don't host anything. You don't have anything. So you certainly don't have a database.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to complete this story and build applications that are stateful, you need a place to interact with your data and store your data, and I think Astoria can contribute there as well
mm-hmm.
as a class of applications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's even conceivable that there could be... So right now, the model presumes that the entity that's providing the data is going to be running SQL Server, running Visual Studio, building these entity data models. That's, in theory, something which could become also a service on the web, right? For people
Don't
actually want to manage that infrastructure, but they want the, you know, the benefits of it.
Yeah, that's perfectly thinkable. Like right now, we have this experimental service out there, you know, in Astoria.mslabs.com.
Yeah.
But, you know, that one is an experiment. And, like, the one thing I know is it's not going to survive in that form, but I think there is an opportunity there. And we will see how that evolves. But, yeah, absolutely. I think there is an opportunity there for people that just don't want to think about how the data problem, like, no thinking about storage or anything. You just ask for the data.
Yeah.
And you should have it up there in the cloud.
Yeah. What's the next phase here for you?
We got solid feedback from the mix release, but we also got, we not only said, yeah, that's cool, but we also got actual feedback on these things work, these things don't, there are good ideas, bad ideas. So next steps are we'll take all the feedback we got. Now we have sort of, we're like a full-on team. Like this story started as an incubation effort, and now it became a full-on effort.
Okay.
And it has a team, and so we're going through the detailed design, and we are covering areas that we didn't cover in the CTP, like security and more sort of declarative policies for both security, caching, and a few other things.
Mm-hmm.
And so next iteration is we'll sort of go deep, work on the design. Over time, I'll try to open up the design exercise itself and try to be as transparent as possible on what we're talking about
mm-hmm.
every week or something,
mm-hmm.
so people can chime in. And at some point, I cannot tell quite yet where, when, like we haven't decided the exact schedule, but at some point I would expect that we'll iterate again, probably towards the end of the year with public bits that are closer to the real deal.
Yeah.
And we'll see. Like once we have public bits out there that are close to what we think should be the shippable version of it, then we'll take another round of feedback to see if that is really in good shape for being sort of a V1 release, and then we'll ship it. So the one thing I know is we're going to iterate fast over this, both for the intermediate iterations and also for the release. This is not a sort of a long-term project for a V1. I would like to iterate a V1 very quickly.
Good.
And then, you know, once we have it out there and we see what real applications are being built, we'll iterate again and add whatever, you know, key elements were missing from the first release.
Excellent. Well, I assume people can watch your blog to stay up to date with what's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. They can. Folks can go to my blog at blogs.msdn.com/Pablo. And they can also send me feedback from there. I'm happy to hear all stories about it, good and bad.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much, man. This was good.
Yeah, thanks to you for your time.
Sure. Okay, thanks. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.